So it is my great pleasure to welcome for the first time here to the Many Rivers Books and Tea, Dr. Dorina Rode. She'll be speaking with us tonight about her book, The Answers Are Within, a collection of personal stories, Developing Awareness. A longtime resident of Sonoma County, Dorina recently returned after a foray of 7 years, I didn't realize that, in the desert of Arizona, where she took advantage of the low cost of living to focus on spiritual practice, meditate. You're not the only person who's done that, I tell you. I have other friends who are right there right now. Meditate and clear childhood trauma she had previously repressed. Please join me in welcoming Dorina Rode, PhD, to Many Rivers Books and Tea.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me. Really appreciate it. It's really nice to see some familiar faces and also some people I haven't met before. I'm hoping that something I share this evening will be a contribution to everyone, actually. So I wanted to start by asking a question. And my question is, how was your morning? How was your day today? You know, did you wake up feeling peaceful? Did you wake up feeling invigorated, excited? No? How many people woke up like, yeah, this is like vacation day? No.
Sometimes
we do. And for me, most of the time now, I do. And that's kind of what's brought me out of the desert or back to wanting to speak. I feel like a fledgling, but it's like there's been this transformation, and I'm looking back on what are the things that created that change. From fairly severe and regular depression, a lot of anxiety for post-traumatic stress, and now completely gone, or at least, you know, where it used to be the average of like 7 to 10 on that scale, like that really high, now it's like the 1 to 3 area. So it's what I consider completely gone in respect. And how my day looks like today is that, you know, I get up, and there's never an alarm clock. I just kind of get up and I kind of roll out of bed. I move over to my sitting chair and I do my morning practice. I meditate. And then the sun comes up a little bit. I move downstairs. I start the fire to keep warm. And then I move outside and I do, you know, I'm in Occidental. This morning was amazing. Dappled light through the redwoods. You know, sometimes there's that morning mist. And I do my Qigong. And then I do Tai Chi, sometimes I do a Vajra dance, which is just an amazing mandala dance that I do. And it's kind of blissful. You know, I have, like 2 days ago, I like turned around with my Tai Chi and like 30 feet away, there's a deer just kind of like, what's she doing? You know, looking at me. And I'm able to receive that and take that in. And so it feels like a blessing to be able to actually feel that every day. And every day feels like a vacation day. You know, I'm like, I've got a list of things I want to do. I've got projects and I've got space to do it. So it feels really expansive, which is not how it was. And it's kind of ironic because 27 years ago, I lived at the same place that I've come back to, the same house. And it was like day and night. From what it is like now. And during that time, I got involved with someone who was verbally abusive, emotionally abusive. They were just mean, a mean person. And for some reason, I couldn't get out of that relationship. I was like, this is baffling. I'm like a strong, independent woman. And here I am kind of like, you know, my subconscious mind is keeping me here. There's something keeping me here. I didn't know what it was. But I was desperate enough, I started looking for help, and I had some professionals recommend a 12-step program. So I'm like, okay, I'll try anything at this point. And so I really devoted myself to the spiritual principles that are embodied in the steps. And I started living those spiritual principles and trying them out, because it was like really, I was testing to see if things would work. You know, are the things that they're telling me, do they actually work, or is this all kind of like fluff? You know, they say things like, you know, surrender, and there's spiritual tools like giving gratitude as being possible ways to change our reality and change our life. And what I found was kind of the accumulation in this book. The stories in this book are me trying out those different tools There's a story about how I got a traffic ticket and I gave thanks and what happened. There's a story about how I got robbed and I used the tool of reframing to change how I felt about that. There's a story about surrender and how I use the surrender process to change my money reality. This book first was written because I couldn't find any books like it. So it's one of those things, I say, if you can't find a book, maybe it's your opportunity to write it. And what I was looking for when I was working the 12 steps is I wanted a book that was inspirational, that was not religious, that was spiritual. I wanted some mundane person like me who was living spiritual principles and what it was like on a day-to-day business basis. And I couldn't find anything written that way. And, you know, and I, at this point, I have to say, you know, it's got to be non-religious because I identify, I'm a Taoist, Buddhist, Christian, pagan, you know, whatever else is left. One of those people. So I'm not religious, and I draw from all different kind of traditions, and I'm interested in kind of one thing, which is reaching my fullest potential, which I consider enlightenment, which is basically getting rid of all the mental afflictions that I have, the things that disturb my peace of mind. So when I couldn't find that, not right then, but later, when I was unemployed, when the Great Recession, as they call it now, happened, I wrote the stories that are in this book. So I want to read a couple things just for the fun of it. One of them is like the surrender process itself, and I talked about how I used that process to change my money reality, and there's a story in here about that. But I just kind of want to give you a flavor for what's in the book in terms of how I think. And here I have a chapter on called On Believing, which is about me kind of looking at the different beliefs that I had and like what kind of substance they had, to really questioning the things that I believed and how my beliefs affected my reality. And I'm always interested in how people can argue about beliefs, and it really wouldn't change anything whether it was this way or that way. So I'm interested in beliefs that like actually make a difference. You know, if I believe there's a God, will it change my day? You know, if I believe there's this doctrine is true, is it going to make any difference to me? Or what's really essential? But in the 12 steps, there's a big thing on surrender. So, and I was like playing with that idea, like what would that give me if I surrender, whatever that is. And there's one Bible story that I like a great deal. In fact, I absolutely love the story of Noah. This story is a fantastic depiction of surrender. Now imagine yourself waking up one morning and getting the urge to build a large boat. Right? You just wake up and you get this urge, I'm going to build a large boat. Never mind that you live in a dry, barren area hundreds of miles from water. You want to build a large boat. Now perhaps Noah was told to build the boat by God or an angel. But since I have not spoken to God or angels, I prefer to imagine that if I was Noah, the message would have come to me as a quiet desire or an inner sense. Now I can imagine myself there in the Holy Land trying to get this crazy idea out of my heart and mind. Day after day, I would keep thinking about building the boat until finally I would just start doing it. Then my friends and neighbors would stop by and laugh at me. Hey, how are you going to get that boat to the sea? The story reminds me of the many times I've gotten a sense to do something that did not quite make sense, only to find out later what gifts were brought by that action. The desire to do something is one way we are guided. I was told that really early on. The desire to do something, because I wanted to know, like, how do I work the 12 steps? You know, we do this thing where we surrender. I didn't have a God, so it's like, how do I know what right action is? How do I know I'm surrendering? Well, I was told the desire to do something is one way we are guided. Okay, so I'm going to follow that desire. Now, when a friend first told me that following my heart was right action, I was not sure I believed it, but it made sense. Certainly, following my heart sounds like something that would make me happy. Still, I clung to some fear that it would only make me happy on a short-term basis. I worried about being irresponsible and thought that following my heart might eventually lead to my ruin. I tested it out and have been quite pleased with the results. And that's the story later in the book about how I changed my money reality. Because that's the first thing that I surrendered. I said, hey, what if I never worked again because I had to or because of money? And that was the question I asked, and I tried it, and I thought for sure I'd end up homeless. Or someplace, you know, I ended up in the desert, but that's another story, right? But I found, I've never been told to build a boat yet. I don't know what we would be asked to build in Sonoma County. So that's a little bit about, you know, so I was really interested in spiritual principles. And I started working the 12 steps because I was in that abusive relationship. And I have to say that the relationship got better. So, you know, we got married, we had a kid, I kept growing, my partner didn't, we got separated, we got divorced. And I'd like to say then I was, you know, that was it. I was like free, everything was wonderful. When I look back, because I'm talking about depression tonight, right? When I look back, you know, the truth is when I was with him, I wasn't depressed. I was too, like, dramatic. I mean, there was dramatic, there was emotions, there was crying, and there's anger and all this stuff that was arising because of that, you know, tension. But when I left him, what happened was I became depressed. And I think beyond that is what happened is I continue to develop my awareness. And really what I found was that I had chronic constriction and tightness in my body that I never knew I had before. I mean, if I talked to someone just from Sebastopol, like, knew me 10 years ago, she goes, God, you were dark back then. It's like, oh. It's like, I don't have that anymore. But I wasn't even aware that I was dark back then because I didn't have that awareness. And so the process of really looking at my beliefs and really surrendering to spiritual principles started to develop my awareness. And I also started with the questioning. I also started working, I worked with Dr. Lois Johnson. She's a local physician, and she used to have her private practice on Pitt Avenue here in Sebastopol. And I was her chief medicine maker. And it's always kind of comical to me because in the office there was a receptionist who was a shaman. Wow. you've got people coming in, right? And you've got the shaman handed out backwards to do some stuff around. It's like, that woman's got death on her, and, you know, she's doing a whole ceremony out back. And I'm like, oh, wow, this is an interesting place to work. But I was the chief medicine maker, and the shaman was actually tutoring me on how to speak to plants and how to actually make good medicine. And in that process, she always told me to spend time with plants. So we'd get these little spiritual nuggets of spend time with plants. And I didn't know what that meant, but she said they would teach me. And I just, okay, what's that going to look like? What are they going to teach me? And the first story is on some of the things I did with her in developing intuition. And there's a little bit about, you know, what was happening for me at that time. So in the middle of the story, I talk about, you know, during this period in my life, a lot of things was happening to me. For 30 years, I claimed that I was insensitive. Certainly, I didn't have any intuition. I was a logical, practical person. You know, hard science. Chemistry, degree in physiology. Logical, practical. Now I find myself at a crossroads. The old, insensitive shell was falling off, and a new, sensitive woman was emerging. One of my herb teachers once stated that people having their first experience with alternative consciousness or energetic awakening often make a big deal about it. He was probably talking about me. I was a little freaked out. I was feeling things I had not felt before, and I wanted to know if they were real and what they were. Now, I recall calling people and talking about all the strange things I was experiencing. I would have weird tingles on my face for no reason, or I'd find my body would just like dissolve. I'd be like a noodle during a psychotropic reaction to an herb like pedicularis. I was feeling strange things and searching for a way to have these things make sense. Any normal person would have passed these off as just oddities, maybe. But to me, they were a big deal. Something was happening. It was something big. I wasn't sure what it was, and I did not know how it fit into my old frame of reference. In retrospect, I guess I was just becoming more aware of subtle energy, which made sense. I was doing a daily practice of like Qigong and Tai Chi and stuff like meditating, and but I wasn't feeling the Qi up until this point. Now, during this period, I spent a good time, deal of time meditating. I would sit on my couch and feel my body. I lived with Kim. She was there. I also would climb up into a great oak I had in my backyard and just sit there. This was me spending time with plants. I spent a lot of time in that oak. I would sit there thinking there must be some way to experience the oak more, to feel more connected, to feel more connected with it, and to be more in relationship with it. I would sit in the oak trying to stir up a conversation with it, but it would only hold me. That was me being with plants. Now, I would also go for walks in the forest. Sonoma County is a beautiful place to live. I enjoyed the coastal ranges, especially in the winter when it was raining. There are some excellent trails on the first ridge off the ocean. In the winter, I would walk them and collect usnea and mirica. Usnea is a lichen. It hangs off the trees, dry and brittle all summer, but it becomes moist and vibrant after the first rain. Mirica is a California native tree. The root bark makes a potent medicine for shrinking and stimulating tissue. What was important to me was this being with plants. When I think mirica, I don't think respiratory infection or slowly healing damaged gut. I think winter solstice, slight mist, the odor of rich, humic soil, the confusion of intermingled roots from a nearby willow, and the snap of mirica root bark as it pops off under my bite, followed by a pungent taste. I think, total bliss. I was never happier than when I was out in nature with plants. On one of my adventures, I drove up the Northern California coast past Jenner. I pulled off the road and began walking through the woods. It was cool but sunny, a perfect fall day. I was walking through a mixed evergreen forest, mostly live oak. Very, very nice. I walked until I came to a beautiful tree. It was old, huge, and covered with moss. It was one of those trees with low spreading branches that are perfect for sitting in. I was reminded of my oak back home, so I sat down to enjoy the peace. At home, when I sit in my oak, I feel like I'm sinking into a soft mattress. Well, the oak is not soft at all physically, but there's a quality of rich quiet or a deep peace. If I'm anxious, sitting in an oak calms me. I sat down in this old moss-covered tree and expected the peaceful feeling to settle over me. Instead, I realized I was feeling more agitated. I was actually becoming uncomfortable. I had felt more peaceful and still while I had been walking than I did sitting in that tree. It was confusing. Then I looked up. Well, it was not an oak at all. It was a bay tree. I laughed. Of course it was a bay tree. Bay trees are also used in medicine. They are vasodilators. They are movers. The leaves can be used as a steam to clear out the respiratory passages. They can be added to baths to relieve muscle soreness from overexertion. I was laughing because I realized I had learned how to listen. I sat in a tree and it told me it was a stimulating tree. I became stimulated and agitated. I never get agitated when sitting in an oak tree. I would have never expected to experience a difference between bay and oak. But the bay was energetically stimulating, and given its clinical indications, that was not surprising. I was delighted. In that moment, I understood the value of spending time with plants. So it's one of the things that I want to emphasize, and that is, people can say, like, this crystal does this crystal does that, this plant does this, that plant does that, but until we actually have an experience, it's words, it's intellectual. And once we have that experience, it's there's a richness that then fills our life, and then we can use that and apply it. And so the mysteries that, you know, they can't be taught, we can talk about them, but the truth is they have to be experienced, which means all that time I did sitting in plants, sitting with plants, did something internally that I wasn't aware of. And I always have like a pitch for practice, basically. Because it feels like you're doing nothing. I'm sitting in an oak and I'm like, you know, what am I doing here? And, you know, it's like I'm being with plant. It won't connect with me. It won't talk to me. It's just, you know. But until I then sat in a bay tree, I didn't realize, oh, the oak is, yeah, it's very quiet. It's very supportive. It's very, you know, it's all these other qualities. And I had that experience. It's like, okay. And I also got it that I can tell the difference between an oak. Insensitive knows the difference between an oak and a bay tree on an energetic level. And so for me it was the beginning of becoming more aware of what I'm aware of. And you know, and today I know that I'm aware of a lot more than just plants. It's like I can pick up and know kind of what people are feeling or where they're at. Where back 20 years ago, I had no clue on on people. I couldn't feel the cues or see the cues. I mean, you can kind of like see things sometimes and analyze it, but there's a sense of like, okay. When I work with people clinically and I help people, I do change facilitation with people. It's one of the ways I'm able to work with people is like, okay, I can sense and get a sense of where people are at, and then when things are changing, to be able to kind of key in. It's kind of hard for me to articulate, but it's all about this building of a developing awareness and how it can expand so that not only was it in one area, but it's in more areas, and I can see that it can continue getting richer. I mean, wouldn't it be incredible to be able to walk into a room and have the awareness, not only the awareness of kind of where people are, what they're doing, but the awareness of what I can contribute, and to have that really right there with different people or the world, the same kind of thing to have. I mean, a lot of people do have the awareness of what's happening all over the world. But then the question is, you know, what can we do to contribute? How are we already having the awareness of how already here in Sebastopol, in this room right now, we are contributing to shifting and changing things other places. To have that awareness of how we're all interconnected as an experience, and not, you know, you hear, we are one. It's like, but it's, you know, but then we act like we're not one, kind of thing. And so it's like, but once you have the experience, it changes everything. And so that it might be a little pitch for practice, because there's no way to do it without practice. And what I realized was that what you can practice can be a whole wide range of things. So when I came back to looking at the book, which was actually written, like I said, kind of during the Great Recession, right? 2006 was the first edition. I came back to it this last year and I said, okay, things have changed. And what can I add to this book that will create it as more valuable, that will really illustrate what's going on, what happened during that time for me? And so I added to the end of each chapter some questions and tools to help people develop awareness. And they go beyond just normal intellectual processing. You know, you get workbooks and you do your workbook or whatever, but the idea is to kind of get you in a place where you can expand. And with depression, and I want to talk about, I came up with just this morning, 7 tricks for eliminating depression. And the first one is just accepting it. So there's this thing that we do where we resist it and we react to it, which then I think creates it hanging on longer. You know, what we resist persists, basically. And that's what I used to do. I'd wake up back then and I'd be depressed. And I'm like, oh, you know, nothing had changed in my life. One day was like, yes, this is good. And then the next day I'm expecting the same thing. I'm going to expect to feel like I like life. But I'd wake up and I would like, it'd be like this cloud fell on. And I'm like, there's nothing that's changed. How come I can't get up? How come I can't do anything? I didn't know what was going on. I'm just depressed. And I would fight it. And then some wise person told me, you know what you need to do when you first get depressed? I'm like, oh, she's going to tell me finally. This was a wise person. So I was very excited. I'm going to have the key to ending depression. She goes, well, you got to be depressed. It's like, ooh, okay. So I did that. I was really easy. Okay, I can be depressed. I know how to do that. So it actually, things change. I'm like, then I started expecting every time I would be depressed, it would just leave, because that's how fast it did at that time. It was mm-hmm. like, oh. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, if I'm not resisting it, then that in itself is a tool. But it also, even if it doesn't just disappear because I'm not resisting it, it puts me in a place where I can become curious, which is like my second trick. So when I become curious about my depression, I start asking questions. Someone at one of the talks I did said, you know, you talk about, for me, my depression wasn't depression. It was actually repressed memories coming up that I couldn't quite get a hold of. And so back when I thought I was depressed, I was actually, I was processing trauma. So I wouldn't call that, you know, you can call it depression, but it's processing trauma. And so that was my story. But you need to question it. Like, what is this? You know, you wake up, you're depressed, or you're feeling a weird mood. It's like, what is this? You know, can I change it? Is this physical? Is this emotional? Is this mental? You know, those are just some of the questions. One of my favorite questions is at the end of the developing intuition chapter, and it's basically, you know, what do I know that I'm pretending not to know or denying that I know? For me, there's so many things that I pretend not to know, like my whole repressed childhood, you know. And maybe if I had been given that question, things might have been, it would have opened up some space for other things to have realization, to process things quicker, to release things quicker. You know, and then can I change this? So that's the other thing. It's like something comes up, and the truth is sometimes when I'm depressed, I can change it. Maybe it actually is my thyroid's not working well. You know, for me it was repressed memories. For someone else it might be a biochemical imbalance. So to ask those questions, what I'm suggesting is the answers are within us. And then if we actually start asking questions, maybe not immediately, but an answer will present itself so that we can actually access our own truth and not someone else's truth. So things can change that way. So we're talking about seven ways to eliminate depression. And the first one is when you're depressed, you be depressed. And the second one is creating some curiosity around the depression and asking questions. You know, maybe I'm thinking this is depression's a bad thing. What if it's a good thing? You know, what's right about this that I'm not getting? How does this serve me? Is this really space? You know, is this creating some space for me to do some introspective work? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, how can I use it to my advantage? So just different ways to be curious about what's happening within. Then for me, the key thing that I learned early on too was, you know, what is the kindest thing I can do for myself right now? So the trick number three is asking myself, you know, what is the most loving thing I can do for myself right now? So yeah, I woke up, or I'm feeling depressed, or I'm feeling anxious, whatever I'm feeling, and what's the most loving thing I can do for myself right now, which might be completely different for different people. But usually, you know, we're trying to change something. Let's just, if we get to a place where we can actually acknowledge or accept that there's some sort of emotional thing arising, we don't have to even own it. It's not ours. You know, it's just arising in our mind stream or in this whatever we call ourselves. Then we can look at, like, how can I take care of myself given this whatever it is that I don't understand? And then we can take action in that way. So we've got some space. When we're not running from it, we can actually take care of ourselves better. So then the next thing for me that I found really useful, a trick to kind of eliminating depression, is to do some movement. So for me, a big thing was Qigong and Tai Chi. And I'm still, even today, like if I wake up and I'm just like a little bit funky, I go outside, I do 15 minutes of Qigong, and it completely changes everything. And that's what those practices are designed for. They're designed to get your wind flowing the right way, get your qi, your prana flowing a certain way, and if it's flowing correctly, your mind clears and becomes whatever, peaceful or something. And it doesn't have to be like Qigong or Tai Chi or yoga even. It can be dance. It could be running. You know, it could be whatever movement really attracts you. And you could ask, which kind of movement would actually create the most change for me. So go back within and find your own personal answer in terms of the kind of movement. And I found, for me, I found the Qigong was really twofold, because they say, you know, when you do practices like yoga in Tai Chi, you've got the problem with that actually increases awareness and brings more stuff up. So sometimes I don't know if I'm making it worse or better. But I think long term I'm making it better. So that's my belief. It's like I believe that it actually is, and given my childhood, it seems to have worked. So now I can be an endorsement. Yes, I did Qigong and Tai Chi, and Qigong almost every day for the last 20 years. And things got worse before they got better. And then they got really amazing. So that was, it's like it seems like it really did what they say it's supposed to do, right? They say it's supposed to bring stuff up. That's the first thing I read about Qigong. People get emotional stuff coming up when they do it because you're clearing stuff out. And I had a lot of stuff to clear out. So, and now there's very little to clear out in there. So I still get a few things now and then, but there's not a whole lot to clear out. So we've got being depressed. Step one. We've got some curiosity around that. We've got, you know, what can you do to take care of yourself? Which might be a little tough luck because one of those things might be movement, and you might have to, when I was in transition, still getting a little depression, there'd be like, I'd wake up and I'm like, I don't feel like doing anything. So I'd like, okay, you don't have to do anything today. But if it came at the second thing, you need to move. You know, and now I know that the movement always works when they're not doing something. Doesn't every once in a while it's the right thing, but usually if there's something there, having some sort of movement clears it out. The next thing, number five, is going to be recharge. And so what do you do to recharge? For me, you heard, it's like I spend time with plants. I get, you know, I do my Qigong outside because it makes a huge difference. There's two things about doing it outside. One is I walk out the door, and if I don't feel like doing it, I don't let myself back in until I do it. So it's a trick. I'm like, it's like cold, and I'm like, I don't want to do it, but you can't go back in. Somehow it's wired in that way. It's like, to me, that's, you know, and people do that. You drive to the gym. You don't think about what you're going to have to do when you get there. But you've driven there, so you walk in and it seems like it happens then. You get on an automatic thing. So, but you need to think about, like, what recharges you? So you've got some depression, you've got some anxiety, you've got something, and it's part of that self-care. What kind of things recharge you? Is it tea? Is it books? You know? Is it meditation? Is it prayer? Is it nature? Is it music? Is it movies? So you've got a whole list, right? And some things that you're going to be different. But think about, like, what really nourishes you? And that's on your list. It's like, okay, what could I do to recharge myself?
Good.
So then you've got that tool as well. So the next trick is going to be, and I've used this one too, is to do service. So now there's this thing in Buddhism, which I really like, this cause and effect law, right? You've got, and it's probably everywhere, everybody's got this law that's cause and effect, right? So if you've got a condition you want to get rid of, what you do is you go out and you help someone else get rid of it. And so if your part of your depression is loneliness, then you can go to a nursing home and you can be sociable with people, right? You help someone who's lonely. But service in general just works really well, because if you're depressed, what is it? It's like not being motivated, it's not feeling, I don't know, connection. There's all these, you can figure out when you're questioning and being curious about your depression, you can see how it manifests for you. There was a period at that Great Recession where I lost the job that I was like counting on, you know, that was paying the house payment, that was actually feeling like I was going to like move into the world with this job, and it was good, the horizons were happening, and I'm like, yes, everything, perfect. And they fired me. You know, and they weren't supposed to, because I had worked there before, and I had quit, and they had asked me back, and they had me do all the high level technical things, and then they fired me. And it was just so like weird. And so I spent a lot of time in meditating, but I found that I was in such kind of a dark, draggy, you couldn't get my face to smile place, that I went to the soup kitchens and I would drag in, And I would serve, but people were nice to me. Mm-hmm. And I was really, really low. And it's hard sometimes to find people that will just let you volunteer really quick. But the soup kitchens will.
Okay.
Like, there's other places where, you know, I've been, you know, like there's this bunny rescue in Phoenix, and you gotta interview, and then they won't let you touch the bunnies until you pass the interview, and then, you know, 5 weeks later you can actually volunteer, which is great. But I'm like a short term person. I'm desperate today. I need to go someplace. So it was Petaluma, I think, and it was like, yeah, the little somewhere they served people, and they would let me come in and help cook, and they'd let me serve people.
Oh, I know where that is.
Yes. Yes. So they were fabulous, and you know, it didn't take long before I was feeling better, and I started thinking, well, I probably should find some volunteer things that use more of my other high-level skills, right, besides serving food. but it's a savior kind of thing. So it's one of the tools that I've heard people, not just myself, but other people who have struggled with depression. It does something, because part of depression can be the lack of, like, meaning. You know, what kind of flavor does your depression have? And certainly after I lost that job, which I thought was going to create my meaning in life, I was feeling like there was no meaning. And so there's a good solution there. So number seven, my last trick for destroying depression is about creating a support network. So, and a lot of times we need to create that before we get depressed. And depending on kind of the person you are, so there's this, well, like I say, I've got this trick, right, when I do Qigong to get outside, and that creates, you know, for me, and I'm an introvert, so I do a lot of things by myself, but if I was looking for support, you know, I had the 12 steps, right, so I had meetings I could go to. That was one of the things I did. And since I'm an introvert, I went to meetings to meet people, so that I could get phone numbers, so that I could network with them later when I was depressed, or when I had something come up, or when I had a need. So other people are more sociable. So if you're more of an extrovert, then you do things like this. You come to a talk like this. You connect with people. You know, and you can be feel supported. And then maybe you can connect with people and get phone numbers, and then, you know, you've got resources later. So the thing is, it's kind of like you got to do your kind of work before to create the support network you're going to need. You know, and it might look like, you know, you do yoga a couple, you know, if you can look at the things that recharge you and the things that nourish you. You know, maybe yoga class here, exercise class there, you've got a book club here, you've got, you know, different kind of, you know, religious type organizations you can plug into. So create what's going to work for you, and then kind of rely on it when and if stuff comes up. So create that community for connection. So that's my seven tricks. Are there any questions about anything in particular? Yeah.
When you described addressing new practices, and you're talking about as if you were going to believe something worked and then try it out. Could you describe a little bit more about the mental process of deciding to believe something versus just trying it out to see what works?
So, like the surrender, is that kind of what you're trying to
pick anyone and surrender be fine, but I'm thinking you had a number of different modalities that you had been exposed to, and not having experience with them, for example, you might wonder whether something was going to be helpful. I had the feeling, or the sense, that you were trying different things to see how they worked for you.
Like the gratitude one.
Yeah. Like, if you don't know whether you want to believe it, but you want to try it out, do you tell yourself you believe it for now and then do it, or act as if you believe it? Because for me, it brings up, how do I do this without trying to fool myself?
So
why not fool yourself?
Yeah, that's good. That's what I think.
Because I can.
What's wrong with
you?
I do that all the time to get through.
Well, I do. I mean, I can't.
Part of my therapy.
I can do it there intentionally, but I can't fool myself intentionally.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Mm-hmm.
But how do you know which one's which?
So
you are fooling yourself.
Question. Did you go any?
Sorry,
did you do anything like that when you were going through the process?
Was there a specific one that you hit? You pick one, because I'm trying to.
Well, actually, I don't. I think the. Okay, let's pick the flower, the communication with the plant.
Okay.
And the sensitivity to that.
Okay.
Now, you described pretty well the realization came upon you, because you'd just been sitting with the oak and sitting with the oak and sitting with the oak, and then you sat in the bay and read, oh, this is different.
Okay, so like when I start that story, actually you've got the beginning part of the story.
Uh-huh.
I talk about being in the office with the shaman, and we're with a plant, and she's like, okay, you say this prayer, you ask to see the plant spirit, and I'm like, I don't see plant spirits. Right? You know, that doesn't happen. And of course, because she told me, asked to see the plant spirit, and what do you see? She's asking me, what do I see? It's like something pops in my head. You know? Mm. I'm like, this is what I saw. And she I think it is kind of an acting as with. You pretend. You imagine. Something popped in. It was a little dwarf-like thing. I was out talking to Siberian ginseng. This little dwarf pops in. That's all I see. It's a little Disney character, because it's coming right. It's coming from like my collection in my head. I don't know why it would look like a little dwarf from Snow White and Seven Dwarfs.
Yeah.
Because that's what's in my memory. I liked that book when I was a kid. So that's what I ended up with. I have a plant spirit that's this big, and he looks just like a little Disney dwarf. And she laughed at me. So there was two things that happened there. She said, oh, it made itself look small. I'm like, okay, whatever. There were other times, though, when she would validate what I saw. So that was helpful, too. She's like, okay, well, I said, I saw this haystack kind of thing with a black, just this black hair kind of stuff. And she said, well, there was two things that happened. One thing is some big black thing came out of your body, and that's how the person who picked that herb you're talking to, that's what it looked like. So I'd call Hawaii and say, does the person who picked this hair have really long black hair? And they go, oh my God, is there hair in your herb? I said, no. No, there wasn't any hair in the herb. So there was a certain level of validation, which was important to me. At this point, I've had enough validation where I just kind of go with it. So there's that. Once you have like one experience, you say, okay, I can tell the difference between this. You kind of have to let go. For me, when it comes to developing awareness, I have to kind of trust that I know and go with that.
Yeah.
And it's not... So oftentimes the question is, if I did know what it would look like. I ask that to myself, So back in the good old days, or when I worked with my practitioners, they'd say, okay, I'd say, I don't know. They ask me a question, I don't know. It's like, what happened when I was five? It's like, I don't know. Well, if you did know, what would that be?
Mm-hmm.
So it drops me into, there's a certain level of where I need to get, like, in a theta brainwave state, or, drop down a little bit, and then what comes up with that?
Yeah.
You kind of have to
okay,
bypass
so it's fair
mind.
To say that you don't need beliefs to do what you do.
No. In fact, you can pick different beliefs. I mean, I can switch back and forth. I'm like really good at using what I call a God model. And I'm also really good at using a model that doesn't have a creator being. And I just switch back and forth. In fact, sometimes it's easier to have God doing everything. It feels good. It's resonant. It's like, okay, relying on God. I've done that. Somebody gave me this little piece of paper. I rely on God. I went to UC Davis. I had this little paper. I'm relying on God. All of a sudden, I was like enrolling for a PhD and had found my major professor, all in one day. And I was relying on God. So no, do I believe in God? No, but whatever, it worked. So you don't have, and in fact, you're better off without any beliefs, or if you have a belief, you can hold it lightly, so that allows for other options. In fact, so the critical things are, for anything, is choice. So the critical thing, like with developing awareness or any... getting rid of anxiety, getting rid of depression, is to actually choose it. So the one thing you need to believe is that it's possible for it to change or be different. So like, I found out the Buddha taught how to not get old, how to not get sick, and how to not die. I'm like, cool, I want all that. Yeah, I do. Well, I can choose. I can change my mind at any time. That's the one thing I learned about choice. You can always change your mind. But right now, yeah, I would like to. That would be really. I would like to find out what that is, and or do that. So, in some sense, I have to believe it's possible, and then I'm choosing it, and that's the big thing. I'm going to choose to do that, and I can change my mind at any time, and we'll see what happens when I make that choice. And the thing that it seems like in our society a little bit is that we're kind of, there's, I don't know, at least in the world that I was living in, there's this thing about making decisions and making conclusions and having, like, I have a diagnosis, this is my problem, you know? So there's all this thing, like, we want to have it all, so then we can be right. You know?
Right,
like,
now.
There's a reason I'm depressed, I've got post-traumatic stress disorder and, you know, generalized anxiety, you know, it's like I've got this. Instead of like, okay, like, I don't, you know, so we make things fixed, and then we create ourselves around it. And so the idea is to get rid of the beliefs and the conclusions and the decisions and create ourselves as something completely, create ourselves in the world as something completely different. So yeah, I would say the critical thing is no beliefs and choose something energetic, like, you know, doesn't have to be fixed at all. And then ask, like, what would it take to create that? And listen, right? Somehow, that's the mystery, right? I can't teach it a mystery.
Isn't it kind of a paradox? Because if you have faith, I don't know, it just seems like a lot of people have some kind of foundation where that makes the faith possible, because they've seen at least some good things happen when they had that faith. Therefore, they might have some kind of belief system that's underlying that, but to not, maybe not hold it, like you were saying.
Yeah.
Not hold it too hard. Not. In other words, it's like, to me, it's sort of a paradox.
Well, what about if
you
the
know,
faith
like
is in
I
that?
I believe in something. I do.
Well, what if the faith is in that anything's possible?
Yeah, that's good.
Exactly. So there we go. That's my faith. Anything's possible, because then it's not a conclusion. God's the only one who can do it, or, you know, it's like,
right.
It's just anything's possible. I don't know how it happens.
Okay.
It's a mystery. I like saying the work I do is magic.
Yeah.
It's like I do magic.
But then it can be personal or impersonal, and that's the hard part for people, because if it's too personal, then they feel like there's. Then it's too limiting for them, because maybe they're going to, like if you pick a certain religion, for instance, they all think differently. So if you go against the grain with that religion, and because God is personal and God is watching you, you know, everything you mm-hmm. do, then there's a lot of guilt too. If you don't obey God, which a lot of people have struggles with who've grown up in that kind of environment, like me.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have nothing and there's no rules, you can also freak out, because you want some kind of foundation and you want there to be some sort of, you know, I mean, people fall into, some people are obsessive compulsive or whatever. So I guess what you're saying is to don't hold it too tightly, but it's a mystery behind the whole thing.
Yeah.
Somehow.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
You got it.
That
sounds good.
Okay.
The metaphor of the idol, making something into an idolatry. You can make a religion into an idol. You can make God into an idol.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like the challenge of, I think, what I would like to call a living God, which is a God of all possibilities
when you
something happens in the body when you start focalizing this, when you start making something into an idol.
Well, when you say idol, I think of it as out here, and
yes,
maybe that's
yes.
what happens, is you
yes.
then separate from it, and then
yes.
there's rules and stuff you have to follow, instead of it being, like you said, a living God coming
yeah.
through you.
Coming through.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Like moment by moment, instead of just, you know, this map that somebody's already figured out, and I have to go from point A to point B to point, you know.
And I've done that, because I started studying this. I got really excited about enlightenment, you know, not dying, and they told me this is what you do,
okay.
And I got to, like, okay, I got to meditate this way, I've got to reach shamatha, so then I can see, have the direct perception of emptiness, and then that's what you have to do, you know. And I'm like, and then I like got so mm-hmm. I like crap because I was like meditating too much, and I can't. I got PTSD and trauma background, and we don't meditate often. We can't focus often because stuff keeps arising that needs to be cleared. And I had experiences where I'd get distracted. I'm like, why am I distracted? And then I would like go out of meditation, look around for that memory that was coming up, clear it, and then I could go back to meditation and actually focus. I'm like, okay, this is like crazy. You know, so, but yeah, I was like the whining meditator for the first 2 years in the desert. So I didn't mention that. 7 years, but it took quite a few years to get over the whining meditator part, and the part that like finally cracked and couldn't meditate at all for 6 months because I was pushing myself so hard to do it a certain way. Mm-hmm. And I still have that, like, you know, that like linear, you do this to create this. And so I'm like, how do I get it? That's why I had to go back. So I went from Buddhism to Christian contemplative. Okay, God's in charge. Because they're like, you can't do it. I'm like, great, that's what I need to hear. God's in charge. And I can't do it, so all I have to go, I mean, I have to do is sit here and be, and not be in shamatha. And then, you know, I had a Buddhist teacher, and he was telling me, I just wasn't listening to him, you know, that he knows people, you know, that's not the only way that it's, people have this other gradual awakening, that you don't have to have the bells and whistles or whatever. And so, yeah.
Good, but you went to different teachers and different...
Yeah, but I liked one and not the other, so I didn't listen to the second one. But anyway, I'm actually like, okay, I'm just going to like go back to my God model and relax a little bit, but I still get like there's still that little doubt that it's got to be a certain way. It can't be this easy.
that's why I made conversation into my spiritual practice.
And how does that look?
The sign means pause.
Pause your thoughts. He means like your own thoughts.
Or in conversation, if I want to stop and think about something somebody just said, and then suddenly that. So it's about incorporating everything, and you can incorporate it in life. It is the ongoing conversation between everything and everything else anyway. So
did you, in regard to the question, what kept popping up for me was you have to find a way to bypass your mind at least a little bit. If you let your mind control it, then yeah, you're not going to have an experience.
So how do you bypass your mind?
Well, one of the techniques, well, don't really buy into too many techniques, is when thoughts come and thoughts go. You just let them flow. You don't attach to them. You don't follow them with another thought. And you don't believe what you think.
Yeah.
And you don't make up stories.
So to be able to do that, to not believe what you think, I had to have like a realization where I actually caught my mind thinking two things at the same time during meditation. So I'm just curious, it's like, how do you get to a place where you don't believe what you think? Mm-hmm. And then I have to keep reminding myself, remember that time when you were meditating and it got really quiet, and there's this discursive, they call it discursive thought, where there's part that's always like, you know, you're meditating and, you know, you're sitting here, sure, you know, what's for lunch or whatever. You know, there's part that's kind of witnessing, watching what's going on. And it was so quiet that I wasn't having any thoughts, but I could hear this murmuring in the background. And I talk about it in the second volume. I talk about what happened, you know, it's like I could hear something down there, and part of me was just enough discursive that I said, what is that? You know, and I went and I looked for it, the part, you know, so I, and at that moment, I heard it was like, you're meditating. I'm like, are you kidding me? I got two parts of me doing the same thing, you know, and at that moment, not only is there just garbage in there, you know, I have another one about wisdom tooth and where I had all this fear and I just like, yeah, same kind of thing. So I had these like, what they call realizations, right? Experiences that then, so I don't really, but I still have to remind myself, you know, it's you don't believe that. And then at a certain point, you know, how do you get to the place where you really don't believe? you know, when that's...
Well, you can't use the mind to get beyond the mind. You have to guide back. A body, a movement, you know.
Oh. And you catch yourself.
You can't get curious, you're using your mind.
Yeah.
Let go of, or you know, let the curiosity churn in your mind, but then do something physical, something that you resonate with, like Tai Chi or yoga, or
Do you ever say, like, I'm putting this on hold? I do that a lot. Like, I'm just not going to think about it.
Yeah.
If I have enough discipline, you know, it doesn't always work that way.
I remember the first time somebody said, you know, just don't think of it. I had this obsession about a guy that I didn't want to be with, but I ended up, like, with a crush with. Uh-huh. And I'm like, she said, well, just don't. Oh, he doesn't. Don't even think about him. And I'm like, she said it like she thought I could do it. And I remember thinking, oh, yeah, I, like, practiced. And now, you know, 2 years later, after, it's like I could do it. It's like, wow. But 2 years before that, I could not. If someone told me don't think about something, I had no ability to do that.
Wow.
Like, especially when it's one of those things, you know. You know, something at work, somebody, you know, it's like there's situations that really engaged me back then. And now it's like, oh, I can let that, which shows you, you know, where we are at, right? It's like, okay, so if that's possible, that kind of change is possible, what else is possible? Can I get beyond it completely?
That's great.
Yeah.
You can stop your thoughts. Yeah, you just tell them to stop.
Stop leaving.
I want different ones. So yeah, that's the power of choice, right?
Yeah, you just say stop.
How many people can stop their thoughts?
Sometimes.
Yeah, so we got some sometimes. I'm like, okay, the rest of you guys can like or stop repetitive thoughts. The things that get me, like, repetitive thoughts, right? That's what we're talking about anymore, I think. It's like, you know, I've said it, I thought it once. Why do I need to think it over and over and over again?
Reframing
helps. Reframing. So reframing is the process of just telling yourself a different story.
Exactly.
So I got robbed, right? And instead of thinking I've been violated and, you know, all that stuff that comes up, I told myself I donated it. I helped a homeless person.
That's good.
You know, and they didn't take very much. They just took some of the money out of the car, not all this other stuff. You know, so it's kind of like I just, you know, and I had to reframe, you know, homeless is going to be better with kids than, you know, somebody looking for drug money. So, you know, you just, it's a story, right? So some of the things, we don't have to believe it because they're just stories. We believe, you know, which story do you want to believe? Just pick one.
Exactly.
And which one's going to, and my question back then, what's going to bring me more peace? Because there's a whole bunch of stuff that I'm just not going to know. So yeah, if I can tell myself a different story.
Exactly.
And I've got the same thing, because I, like, I don't want to, like, lie to my, you know, I don't want to lie to myself. I want the right story, because I don't want to be fooling myself. And I'm like, well, so you can look at that. It's like, I can be miserable about somebody who robbed me.
Yeah.
Or I can reframe it, tell myself a different story, and it's not going to change anything. I'm not going to not lock the car. I mean, I thought about not locking the car. I said, well, maybe they need to come back and get more. But I said, no, I'm going to lock the car. I donated last night. I'm not donating. You know, you can, like, you know, just open up other possibilities.
Yeah,
why are we all, you know, why get so tight around things? Yeah.
You're making art.
It's a choice. You're being creative.
There we go.
You're being creative. And that's the challenge of every moment.
You can write it off on your taxes.
So yeah, how can you have more fun? Yeah.
I like your position on that beliefs are not necessary. The way I take it when people ask me about some of the things I do or believe, I say, well, I don't believe in gravity. It still holds me down. Well, I don't need to believe in order for things to work.
Right. It's not going to matter. Yeah.
Yeah. Pema Chodron says that beliefs are like opinions. They really are just your opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that our opinions are the truth. In fact, they're our opinions.
Yeah, but and there's that whole thing, what our beliefs actually create our world too. So it then becomes, you know, then it becomes like, what opinions or what beliefs do I want to choose? Because there's a creation there, you know, and you can get into the Buddhist thing about, we, you know, we're creating our world, it's just the mind, and so we are in the matrix. Here we are. You guys ready to wake up? So we're all plugged into the battery machine, right? But so the idea that they are just opinions, but there's something that's
holding.
You know, and the Buddha talked about the two extremes, and I have that I have that habit of going to, well, nothing matters because we just create it, right?
Yeah.
And my beliefs aren't solid, they're just opinions, but like he said, we there's enough people in this room that believe in gravity that we're solid here. And I believe that it's possible that we could change that belief. You know, there's monks' vows that trip me out, because they used to have vows about how many times you could change your gender.
Wow.
It's in the code still. They just kept all of them. I'm like, wait, did they change gender back then? Like, we do it now, but we like all the surgery, and they just like, you can only do it like 5 times, and then you can't do it anymore. it's like, why is that in a monk's vow? That you got, you know, I'm like, so either they had a different ability with changing gender. We think it's really solid, right? But if we really are just creating it, and you know, they say we only last this long, right? A changing thing only lasts a second. So there's all this stuff that's just really like, oh. So for me, yeah, it's that faith that everything's possible, but I can't get too... I have to also realize that there's stuff in my subconscious, 90% of my brain that I'm not aware of, that's actually creating all this. And that for me to change the gravity thing or the gender thing, I would need to, you know, change a lot of stuff down there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have to remind myself that I can work with that stuff sometimes. Like, you know, I can work with my gender, or I can work with the gravity thing. Like, I don't need to change that one. It's not going to make a big deal to me. There might be other things, like, you know, like, okay, you want to change it.
No, if you want to start flying around, you might care.
Those monks, did they use anything like psychedelics or mushrooms or anything?
I don't know. I'm just talking. There's actually, the vows are actually secret. It's Tibetan Buddhism, you know, I've heard a couple kind of thing, and that's the one that, you know, so they're not how they did it. It's just there's a vow that says they can't do it too many times, which suggests that they used to do it, right? Like, they've got some silly vows, like you're not supposed to go 50 feet away from the laundry when it's drying.
What?
You know, because somebody left the laundry out in a rain back when the Buddha was around. So they'd make a rule. You know, and then Buddha said, throw them all out when I die, and they didn't, because he's the Buddha, and he made the rule, so they kept all of them. So they've got 400 vows when you become a Tibetan Buddhist monk or something, and so there's some curious ones, you know.
Do they have a book on silly vows?
No, because they're supposed to be secret vows, so I'm not even, you know.
If the Buddha told them to throw them out, then it seems like
but you know how religions are.
They're not following you.
Yeah, superstition.
That doesn't make sense.
You don't know which ones are good and which ones aren't good. You keep all of them because Buddha knew more than you do, right? You know, that's the thing is out here, right? The idol.
It's like the Bible. How do you know how much it was manipulated? Every time somebody remembers something, they remember it a little bit differently. So, and it gets recorded over and over.
So, but the answers are within. We got that here. Yeah. So it's like, okay, we can take what we like and what's intriguing, and it's we get to tell our own stories. Yeah. So. So cool. So I have an email sign up if you want to get my newsletter. I'm actually going to be writing a blog thing on the 7, you know, so if you wanted to send somebody those 7 tricks for ending depression. And then, thank you I think Rob's going to close us up a little bit.
Well, thank you on behalf of Many Rivers Books and Feet. I will, of course, point out that Darina has copies of her book over here and other ones as well for your consideration, and the sign-up sheet she mentioned. We also have a donation bowl over on the counter there, and that is for people to make observe the Buddhist custom of dana, or generosity, and we share that with our speakers to further their work and retain half to maintain this space for further such events. So thank you all for coming. Thank you, Darina,
thank
again.
You.
And
thank you, everybody.
There we go.
These are nice.
Mm. Yeah, we got more if you want more, too. Got a whole bunch.
I put a rail on my right hand.
How sweet.
keep in my awareness and would make sure I wouldn't be too lazy and comfortable to leave the night.
That happens to me. So I was motivated.
You kept me motivated.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Your name is?
I'm Corinne. Nice to meet you. It's funny because you're talking about changing your story. You know, I was watching the Scamaji video, and a subtime world was actually present. And someone got up and talked about that. That was the main topic. And he was saying how he felt so depressed when he got rejected. It was a trigger, and he went through all this stuff, and he went to have subtime with a friend, and his friend said, just change your story. You don't remember anything. You don't remember things correctly anyway. So what's the difference?
No.
So he went back and he just said, okay. And he talked about how freeing. It's a new story.
New story. Yeah.
I was like, oh, why not? Because then when you were talking, I was like, oh,
I've got all these childhood memories too.
Me too.
It's like I don't even know if they're real. I mean, they are real because when I I got rid of them. It was like it changed things for me, so I think there's something there, but it's like, I don't know if the story is, or if it's energy, or, you know, I don't care.
Passed down from the ancestors, or
like, or somebody else's DNA. Trauma.
I know.
It could be.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. But yeah, I'll sign any books if anyone wants to know.
Tibetan Buddhist, the good stuff.
The more of the story than the book for me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A lot of stories, yeah. Yeah, and the other two are, yeah, the stories.
Teaching stories.
Martin, I thought our
Oops.
Anyway,